harder than he'd realized.
You sure? You don't look fine.
No, really, I've just had a very intense emotional experience.
He held out one of his iPod headphones, as if that would explain it.
On here.
You're crying about music.
The woman looked at him as if he were some kind of pervert.
Well, said Duncan, I'm not crying about it. I'm not sure that's the right preposition.
She shook her head and walked off. He listened from beginning to end twice more while sitting on the bench, and then started to walk home during the third play. One thing about great art, it made you love people more, forgive them their petty transgressions. It worked in the way that religion was supposed to, if you thought about it. What did it matter that Annie had heard the album before he'd had his chance? Imagine all the people who'd heard the original album before he'd discovered it. Imagine all the people who'd seen Taxi Driver before him come to that. Did that deaden its impact? Did it make it less his? He wanted to go home, hug her, and talk about a morning that he would never forget. He wanted to hear what she had to say, too. He valued her insights into Crow's work. She could be surprisingly shrewd sometimes, given her unwillingness to immerse herself in the subject, and he wanted to hear whether she'd noticed the same things that he picked up. The lack of chorus in the 20th Call of the Day, for example, which gave the song a relentlessness and a self-loathing that you couldn't really detect in its finished form. He played this version to anyone who dared to trot out that tired old line about Crow being the poor man's Dylan. The 20th Call of the Day, in Duncan's opinion, was positively 4th Street, but it had more texture and heft. And Tucker could sing. And who'd have thought that And You Are could sound so ominous? On Juliet, it was a song about two people making a connection straight away. In other words, it was a simple, but very pretty, love song. A sunny day before the psychic storms started rolling in from the sea. But on Juliet Naked, it was as if the lovers were standing in a little pool of sunlight that was becoming smaller even while they were talking for the first time. They could see the thunder and the rain already, and it made the album more complete somehow, more coherent. It was a proper tragedy, with the doom about to befall them implied from the very beginning. The flat restraint of You and Your Perfect Life, meanwhile, gave the song a staggering power that was muffled by the histrionics of the rock and roll version. Annie was still in the kitchen when he got home, reading The Guardian at the kitchen table with a cup of coffee. He went up behind her and hugged her, probably for longer than she was comfortable being hugged. "What's that for?" she said, with moderate but determined affection. "I thought you were annoyed with me." "I'm sorry. Stupid. Petty. What does it matter who hears it first?" "I know. I should have warned you it was a bit on the dreary side, but I thought that would make you even crosser." He felt as though he'd been punched in the stomach. He let go of her, took a breath, waited for the impact to fade a little before he spoke again. "You didn't like it?"
"Well, it was all right. Mildly interesting if you've heard the other one. I don't suppose I'll play it again. What did you think?"
"I think it's a masterpiece. I think it blows the other one out of the water. And as the other one is my favourite album of all time..."
"You're not serious."
"Dreary? My God! What else is dreary, according to you? King Lear? The Wasteland?" "Don't do that, Duncan. You always lose your powers of reason when you get angry."
"That's anger for you."
"No, but we're not having an argument. We're trying to discuss, you know, a work of art. Not according to you. According to you, we're trying to discuss a piece of shit."
"There you go. You think it's King Lear. I think it's a piece of shit. Get a grip, Duncan. I love the other one. I suspect most people will feel the same way."
"Oh, most people. We all know what most people think about everything. The wisdom of fucking crowds. Jesus, most people would rather buy an album made by a dancing midget from a reality TV show."
Duncan Thompson, the great populist.
I'm so disappointed in you, Annie. I thought you were better than that."
"Ah, yes, that's the next step. It becomes a moral failing on my part, a character weakness."
"But I'm sorry to say, that's how it is. If you can't hear anything in this..."
"What? Please, tell me. I'd love to know what that would say about me."
"The usual stuff."
"Which is what?"
"Which is, I don't know, you're a moron."
"Thanks.
No, I didn't say you were a moron. I said you were a moron if you can't hear anything in this. I can't.
He left the house again then and went back to the bench overlooking the sea with his iPod. Another hour or so went by before he even thought about the website. He'd be the first to write about the album if he were quick. Better than that, he'd be the first to alert the Crow community to its existence, even. He'd listened to Juliet Naked 4 times, and he'd already thought of a great deal he wanted to say about it. In any case, to wait any longer would be to risk his advantage. He didn't think Paul Hill would have contacted anyone else from the message boards yet, but copies would have been pushed through all sorts of mailboxes this morning. He had to go home, however much hostility he felt toward Annie. He managed to avoid her anyway. She was on the phone in the kitchen, probably to her mother. And who wanted to speak to a member of the family immediately on return from holiday? Didn't that prove something? What, he wasn't precisely sure, but it seemed to him that anyone still so connected to family, to childhood, essentially, was hardly going to be able to respond to the kind of stark adult truths spread generously through the 10 songs on Juliet Naked. She'd get it one day, maybe, but clearly not for a few years yet. Their shared office was on the half landing. The real estate agent who sold them the house was inexplicably convinced that they would one day use the tiny room as a nursery before deciding to move out of town and buy a house with a garden. They would then sell this house to another couple who would, in time, do the same thing. Duncan had wondered whether their childlessness was a direct response to the depressing predictability of it all, whether the real estate agent had inadvertently, but effectively, made their minds up for them. It was the opposite of a nursery now. It contained 2 laptops placed side by side on a workbench, 2 chairs, a machine that converted vinyl into MP3s, and about 2,000 CDs, including bootlegs of every single concert Tucker Crowe had performed between 1982 and 1986, with the exception of the September 1984 show at KB in Malmo, Sweden, which, bizarrely, no one seems to have taped. A constant thorn in the side of all serious students, given that this, according to a normally reliable Swedish source, was the night Crowe chose to do a never-to-be-repeated cover version of Love Will Tear Us Apart. He cleared away the bank statements and letters that Annie had opened and placed by his computer for his attention, opened a document, and began to type. He produced 3,000 words in just under 2 hours and posted it on the website shortly after 5 o'clock that afternoon. By 10 o'clock that night, there were 163 comments from fans in 11 different countries. The next day, he would see that he'd overcooked it a little. Juliet Naked means that everything else Tucker Crowe recorded is suddenly a little paler, a little too slick, a little too digested. And if it does that to Crowe's work, imagine what it does to everyone else's. He hadn't wanted to get into arguments about the relative merits of James Brown or the Stones or Frank Sinatra. He'd meant Crowe's singer-songwriter peers, of course. But the literal-minded hadn't wanted to take it that way. This version of You and Your Perfect Life makes the one you're familiar with sound like something off a Westlife album. If he'd waited, he'd have found that the dressed version, inevitably Juliet came to be known as dressed for ease of distinction, reasserted its superiority quite comfortably after its initial shock. And he wished he hadn't mentioned Westlife at all, seeing as some crazed Westlife fan would come across the reference and spend a day posting obscene messages on the message boards. In his naivety, he hadn't really expected anger. But then he'd imagined himself checking the website idly for some tidbit of gossip, news of an interview with the guy who did the cover art for the EP, say, and discovering there was a whole new album out there that he hadn't heard. It would have been like turning on the TV for the local weather forecast, only to find that the sky was falling in. He wouldn't have been happy, and he certainly wouldn't have wanted to read some other bastard's smug review. He would have hated the reviewer, certainly, and he would probably have decided there and then that the album was no good. He began to worry that his ecstatic praise might have done Naked a disservice. Now nobody, none of the real fans anyway, and it was difficult to imagine that many other people would bother with it, would be able to listen to it without prejudice. Oh, it was a complicated business, loving art. It involved a lot more ill will than one might have suspected. The responses that meant the most to him came via email from the Crowologists he knew well. Ed West's email said simply,
Fuck me, gimme, now. Jeff Oldfield said, with unnecessary cruelty, Duncan thought. That, my friend, was your moment in the sun. Nothing quite as good will ever happen to you again. John Taylor went for a quote from The Better Man. Luck is a disease. I don't want it near me. He created a mailing list and started sending them all the tracks one by one. Tomorrow morning, a handful of middle-aged men would be regretting that they had gone to bed much too late.
Chapter 3. Annie had thought she might be stuck teaching forever, and she'd hated the job so much that even now, simply arriving at the museum 10 or 15 minutes late made her happy. For a teacher, those 15 minutes would have represented a humiliating disaster involving riots, reprimands, and disapproving colleagues. But nobody cared whether she arrived 3 minutes or 30 minutes before a small and infrequently visited museum was due to open. The truth was that nobody really cared if she arrived 3 or 30 minutes after it was supposed to have opened either. Wandering out for a mid-morning takeout coffee was a frequent and rather pitiful daydream in her old job. Now, she made sure she did it every day, whether she needed the caffeine or not. Okay, there were some things she missed. That feeling you got when a lesson was going well, when it was all bright eyes and concentration so thick it felt almost humid, something that might cling to your clothes. And sometimes she could do with some of the energy and optimism and life that you could find in any child, no matter how apparently surly and damaged. But most of the time, she was happy still to have made it under the barbed wire that surrounded secondary education and out into the world. She worked on her own for great chunks of the day, mostly trying to raise funds, although this was beginning to feel like an increasingly pointless task. Nobody, it seemed, had the spare cash for an ailing seaside museum anymore, and possibly never would again. Occasionally, she had to speak to visiting parties of local schoolchildren, which was why she'd been given the chance to escape from the classroom. There was always a volunteer at the front desk, usually Vi or Margaret or Joyce or one of the other old ladies whose aching need to show that they could be useful broke Annie's heart, when she bothered to think about them at all. And when there was a special exhibition being planned, then she worked with Roz, a freelance curator who also taught history at Duncan's college. Duncan, of course, had never been able to bring himself to talk to her in case he got stuck with her during one of his visits to the staff room. Roz and Annie were attempting to prepare an exhibition at the moment, a photographic record of the heatwave summer of 1964, when the old town square was redeveloped, the Stones played the ABC cinema up the road, and a 25-foot shark had been washed up on the beach. They had asked for contributions from residents, and they'd advertised on all the relevant local and social history websites they could think of, but so far they had received only 2 snapshots. One of the shark itself, which had clearly died of some kind of fungal condition, much too gruesome for an exhibition intended to celebrate a golden summer. And one of 4 friends. Co-workers? Having fun on the boardwalk. This photograph had arrived through the mail a couple of days after they'd posted their internet ads, and she couldn't believe how perfect it was. The 2 men were in suspenders and shirt sleeves, and the 2 women were in floral sundresses. The teeth were bad. The faces were lined, their hair was brill-creamed, and they looked as if they had never had so much fun in their lives. That's what she said to Roz when she saw it. Look at them. It's like this is the best day out they've ever had. And she laughed, so convinced was she that their enjoyment was due to a happy trick of the camera, or alcohol, or a dirty joke. Anything but the day out and the surroundings. And Roz said simply, well, that's almost certainly true. Annie, who was about to have a moderately good time on a 3-week tour of the United States, pleasant but not world-shaking, those mountains in Montana, felt humbled. In 1964, 5 years before she was born, it was still possible for English people to feel ecstatic about a day off in a northerly seaside town. She looked at them again and wondered what they did. How much money they had in their pockets at that precise second, how long their holidays were, how long their lives were. Annie had never been rich, but she'd been to every European country she wanted to see, to the United States, even to Australia. How, she wondered, had we got to here from there? To this, from that? She suddenly saw the point of the exhibition that she'd conceived and planned with no real enthusiasm or sense of purpose. More than that, she suddenly saw the point of the town she lived in, how much it must have meant to people that she and everyone else she knew were losing the capacity to imagine. She always took her job seriously, but she was determined to find a way of making visitors to the museum feel what she felt. And then, after the dead shark offering, the photos just dried up. She had already given up on 1964, although she hadn't told Roz that yet, and had been trying to think of a way of broadening the hunt without making the exhibition unfocused and sloppy. Being away for 3 weeks had restored her hope, not least because she had 18 days' worth of mail to sort through. There were two more pictures. One had been dropped off by a man who'd been sorting through his recently deceased mother's things. It was a nice enough snapshot of a little girl standing next to a Punch and Judy booth. The other, sent without a cover letter, was of the dead shark. Annie felt that she had the dead shark covered, and she wished she'd never mentioned it. She'd included it in her request only as a nudge to the memory of the aging population of the town. She might as well have sent them a notice saying, "Diseased shark pics wanted." This one seemed to show a hole in the flank where the flesh had simply rotted away. She went through the rest of the mail, replied to some emails, and went out for her coffee. It was only on the way back that she remembered Duncan's maniacal activity of the night before. She knew that his review had provoked a reaction, because he kept running up and downstairs, checking his email, reading the comments on the website, shaking his head and chuckling at the strange and suddenly alive world he'd inhabited. But he hadn't shown her what he'd written, and she felt she should read it. It wasn't just that, she realized. She actually wanted to read it. She'd heard the music, even before he had, which meant that for the first time ever, she'd formed an opinion about it that hadn't been filtered through his own intimidating evangelism. She wanted to see for herself just how wrong-headed he could be, how far apart they were. She logged on to the website, for some reason she had it bookmarked, and printed the piece so that she could concentrate on it. By the time she'd finished it, she was properly angry with Duncan. She was angered by his smugness, his obvious determination to crow to the fellow fans he was supposed to feel some kind of kinship with. So she was angered by his pettiness, too, his inability to share something that was clearly a value in that shrinking and increasingly beleaguered community. But most of all, she was angered by his perversity. How could those sketches for songs be better than the finished product? How could leaving something half-formed be better than working on it, polishing it, layering and texturing it, shaping it until the music expresses what you want it to express? The more she stared at Duncan's ridiculous piece, the angrier she got, until she got so angry that the anger itself became an object of curiosity to her. It mystified her. Tucker Crowe was Duncan's hobby, and people with hobbies did peculiar things. But listening to music wasn't like collecting stamps or fly fishing or building ships in a bottle. Listening to music was something that she did too, frequently and with great enjoyment. And Duncan somehow managed to spoil it, partly by making her feel that she was no good at it. Was that it? She read the end of his piece again. "I've been living with Tucker Crowe's remarkable songs for nearly a quarter of a century, and only today, staring at the sea, listening to You and Your Perfect Life as God and Crowe intended it to be heard." It wasn't that he made her feel incompetent and unsure of herself and her tastes. It was the reverse. He knew nothing about anything, and she'd never really allowed herself to notice it until now. She'd always thought that his passionate interest in music and film and books indicated intelligence. But of course, it didn't have to indicate anything of the sort. if he constantly got the wrong end of the stick. Why was he teaching trainee plumbers and future hotel receptionists how to watch American television if he was so smart? Why did he write thousands of words for obscure websites that nobody ever read? And why was he so convinced that a singer nobody had ever paid much attention to was a genius to rival Dylan and Keats? Oh, it spelled trouble, this anger. Her partner's brain was dwindling away to nothing while she examined it. And he'd called her a moron. One thing he was right about, though. Tucker Crowe was important. And he revealed harsh truths about people. About Duncan, anyway. When Ross stopped by to find out whether they'd made any progress with the photographs, Annie still had the website up on her computer. Tucker Crowe, said Roz. Wow, my college boyfriend used to like him, she said. I didn't know he was still going. He's not, really. You had a college boyfriend? Yes, he was gay too, it turned out. Can't imagine why we broke up. But I don't understand. Tucker Crowe has his own website? Everyone has their own website. Is that true? I think so. Nobody gets forgotten anymore. 7 fans in Australia team up with 3 Canadians, 9 Brits, and a couple of dozen Americans, and somebody who hasn't recorded in 20 years gets talked about every day. It's what the internet's for. That and pornography. Do you want to know which songs he played in Portland, Oregon in 1985? Not really. Then this website isn't for you. How come you know so much about that? Are you one of the 9 Brits? No. There are no women who bother. My, you know, Duncan is. What was she supposed to call him? Not being married to him was becoming every bit as irritating as she imagined marriage to him might be. She wasn't going to call him her boyfriend. He was 40-something, for God's sake. Partner? Life partner? Friend? None of these words and phrases seemed adequately to define their relationship. An inadequacy particularly poignant when it came to the word friend. And she hated it when people just launched in and started talking about Peter or Jane, when you had no idea who Peter and Jane were. Perhaps she just wouldn't ever mention him at all. And he'd just written a million words of gibberish and posted them up for the world to see. If the world were interested, that is. She invited Roz to inspect Duncan's piece, and Roz read the first few lines. Aw, sweet. Annie made a face. Don't knock people with passions, said Roz, especially passions for the arts. They're always the most interesting people. Everyone had succumbed to that particular myth, it seemed. Right. Next time you're in the West End, go and hang out by the stage door of a theatre showing a musical and make friends with one of those sad bastards waiting for an autograph. See how interesting you find them. Sounds like I should buy that CD. Don't bother. That's what gets me. I played it, and he's completely wrong. And for some reason, I'm bursting to say so. You should write your own review and stick it up next to his. Oh, I'm not an expert. I wouldn't be allowed. They need someone like you. Otherwise, they all disappear up their own bottoms. There was a knock on Annie's open office door. An old lady wearing a hoodie was standing there offering them both an envelope. Roz stepped over and took it. Shark picture, the old lady said, and waddled off. Annie rolled her eyes. Roz opened the envelope, laughed, and passed the picture over. It featured the same gaping, diseased wound that Annie'd seen in one of the other photos. But someone had had the bright idea of planting a small child on top of the shark. She was sitting there with her bare feet dangling inches from the hole. Both toddler and wound were weeping. Jesus, said Annie. Maybe nobody went to see the Rolling Stones here in 1964, said Roz. The dead shark was just too much fun. Annie started writing her review that night. She had no intention of showing it to anyone. It was just a way of working out whether what she thought meant anything to her. It was also a way of sticking a fork into her irritation, which was beginning to swell like a sausage on a barbecue. If it burst, then she could imagine consequences that she wasn't yet prepared for. She had to write at work. Letters, descriptions of exhibitions, captions, bits and pieces for the museum website. But most of the time, it seemed to her, she had to think up something to say, create an opinion from nothing. This was different. It was all she could do to stop herself from following every single one of the strands of thought she'd been chewing on for the last couple of days. Juliet, naked, had somehow given her ideas about art and work, her relationship, Tucker's relationship, the mysterious appeal of the obscure, men and music, the value of the chorus in song, the point of harmony, and the necessity of ambition. And every time she finished a paragraph, the next one appeared in front of her, unbidden and annoyingly unconnected to the last. One day, she eventually decided, she would try to write about some of those things. But it couldn't be here and now. She wanted this essay to be about the two albums, the immeasurable and unquestionable superiority of one over the other. And maybe about what people, Duncan, in other words, thought they heard in Naked that wasn't actually there, and why these people, he, heard these things, and what it said about them. And maybe... No, that was enough. The album had created such mental turbulence that she briefly began to wonder whether it was a work of genius after all. But she dismissed the idea. She knew from her book group that novels none of them had enjoyed could produce stimulating and sometimes even useful conversation. It was the absences in Naked, and therefore in Duncan, that had made her think. Not the presences. Meanwhile, Duncan's friends on the website had been listening, and several more long reviews had been posted. In Tuckerland, it was something like Christmas. Clearly, those who believed had stopped work for the festive season in order to spend time with their extended internet family and, from the look of some of the pieces of writing, celebrate with a few beers or a spliff. "Not a masterpiece, but masterful nonetheless," was the headline of one review. "When will the powers that be release all the real unreleased stuff?" said another, who went on to say that he knew for a fact that there were 17 albums of material in the vaults. "Who's that guy?" she asked Duncan, after trying to read a paragraph of his feverish, occasionally rather affecting prose. "Oh, him. Poor old Jerry Warner. He used to teach English at some public school somewhere, but he got caught with a sixth-form boy a couple of years back, and he's been a bit off the rails since. Too much time on his hands. Why do you keep looking at the website, anyway?" She'd finished her essay now. Somehow, Juliet, naked, or her feelings about it anyway, had woken her from a deep sleep. She wanted things. She'd wanted to write. She wanted Duncan to read what she'd written. She'd wanted the other message board members to read it too. She was proud of it. And she had even begun to wonder whether it might not be socially useful in some way. Some of these cranks, she hoped, might read it, blush a deep crimson, and return to their lives. There was no end to her wanting. "I wrote something."
"What about?"
"About Naked." Duncan looked at her.
"You?"
"Yes, me."
"Gosh. Well, wow."
He smiled, stood up, and started pacing around the room. This was the closest she would ever get to telling him that he was about to become the father of twins. He wasn't thrilled by the news, but he knew he wasn't allowed to be openly discouraging.
"And do you think... well, do you think you're qualified to write something?"
"Is it a matter of qualifications?"
"Interesting question. I mean, you're perfectly at liberty to write whatever you want."
"Thanks.
But for the website, people expect a certain level of expertise."
In the first paragraph of his post, Jerry Warner says that Tucker Crowe lives in a garage in Portugal. How expert is that?
"I'm not sure you're supposed to take him literally."
"So what, he lives in a Portuguese garage of the mind?"
Yes, he's wayward, Jerry, but he can sing every word of every song.
That qualifies him to busk outside a pub. It doesn't necessarily make him a critic.
I'll tell you what, said Duncan,
as if he had a crazy gut feeling that the receptionist should be offered a place on the board of his company.
Let me see it.
She was holding the piece in her hand. She gave it to him.
Oh, right, thank you.
I'll leave you to it. She went upstairs, lay down on the bed, and tried to read her book, but she couldn't concentrate. She could hear the sound of his shaking head all the way through the floorboards.
Duncan read the essay twice, just to buy himself some time. The truth was that he knew he was in trouble after the first reading, because it was both very well written and very wrong. Annie had made no factual errors that he could find, although someone on the boards would always point out some glaring and utterly inconsequential mistake he found when he wrote something. But her inability to recognise the brilliance of the album was indicative of a failure in taste that appalled him. How had she ever managed to read or see or listen to anything and come to the right conclusion about its merits? Was it all just luck? Or was it just the boring good taste of the Sunday newspaper supplements? So she liked The Sopranos. Well, who didn't? He'd had a chance this time to watch her have to come to her own conclusions, and she'd messed it up. He couldn't refuse to put the piece up, though. That wouldn't be fair. And he didn't want to be put in the position of turning her down. And it wasn't as if she didn't get the greatness of Tucker Crowe. This was, after all, a long hymn of praise to the perfection of Dressed. No, he'd post it on the site and let the others tell her what they thought of her. He read it through once more just to make sure, and this time it depressed him. She was better than him in everything but judgment, the only thing that mattered in the end, but still. She wrote well, with fluency and humour, and she was persuasive if you hadn't actually heard the music, and she was likeable. He tended to be strident and bullying and smart-alecky, even he could see that. This wasn't what she was supposed to be good at. Where did that leave him? And supposing they didn't shoot her down in flames, supposing instead that they used her as a stick to beat him with? Naked, which just about everyone had heard by now, was getting a very mixed reaction, and the negative stuff, he feared, had been provoked by his original over-enthusiastic review. He was just beginning to change his mind about accepting her into the community when she appeared in front of him. Well, she said. She was nervous. Well, he said. I feel as though I'm waiting for my exam results. I'm sorry, I was just thinking about what you wrote. And? You know, I don't agree with it, but it's really not bad. Oh, thank you. And I'm happy to put it up if that's what you really want. I think so. You have to include your email address, you know that. Do I? Yeah, and you'll get a few nutters contacting you, but you can just delete them if you don't want to get involved in a debate. Can I use a fake name? Why? Nobody knows who you are. You've never mentioned me to any of your friends? I don't think so, no. Oh. Annie looked rather taken aback. But was that so weird? None of the other crowologists lived in the town, and he only ever talked to them about Tucker or occasionally about related artists. Have you ever had a contribution from a woman? He pretended to think about it. He'd often wondered why they only ever heard from middle-aged men, but it had never worried him unduly. Now he felt defensive. Yes, he said, but not for a while. And even then they just wanted to talk about how, you know, attractive they found him. The only women he could invent, it seemed, were clichéd airheads, unable to contribute to serious debate. He'd only had a couple of seconds to imagine them, but even so, he could and should have done better. If ever he did write his novel, he'd have to watch that. Do women find him attractive? God, yes. Now he was beginning to sound weird. Well, not weird, because homosexual attraction wasn't weird, of course it wasn't, but he was certainly sounding more vehement about Tucker's good looks than he had meant to. Anyway, send me the piece as an attachment, and I'll put it up tonight. And, after only a couple of arguments with himself, he did what he'd promised.
At work the next morning, Annie found herself logging onto the website a couple of times an hour. At first, it seemed obvious to her that she'd want some feedback on what she'd written. She'd never done this before, so she was bound to be curious about the process. Later in the day, however, she realized that she wanted to win, to beat Duncan Hollow. He'd had his say, and for the most part, his say had been greeted by hostility, sarcasm, disbelief, and envy. She wanted people to be nicer to her than they had been to him, more appreciative of her eloquence and acuity, and, to her great delight, they were. By 5 o'clock that afternoon, 7 people had posted in the comments section, and 6 of them were friendly. Inarticulate and disappointingly brief, but friendly nonetheless.
Nice work, Annie. Welcome to our little online community. Good job.
I completely agree with you. Duncan's so far off base, he's disappeared off the radar.
The only person who wanted to make it clear that he hadn't enjoyed her contribution didn't seem very happy about anything.
Tucker Crowe's finished. Get over it. You people are pathetic just going on and on about a singer who hasn't made an album for 20 years. He was overrated then and he's overrated now, and Morrissey is so much better it's embarrassing.
She wondered why someone would bother to write that. But then, why bother? Was never a question you could ask about more or less anything on the internet. Otherwise, the whole bunch of them shriveled to a cotton candy nothing. Why had she bothered? Why does anybody? She was for bothering on the whole. In which case, thank you, Mr. Mazza 7, for your contribution, and thank you, everybody else, on every other website. Just before she shut down her computer for the day, she checked her emails again. She'd suspected that Duncan had told her she had to provide an address in an attempt to frighten her off. Clearly, the comments section was the preferred method of providing feedback. Duncan had implied that there would be a host of homicidal cyber-stalkers spewing bile and promising vengeance. But so far, nothing. This time, however, there were 2 emails from someone called Alfred Mantellini. The first was titled, Your Review. It was very short. It said simply, Thank you for your kind and perceptive words. I really appreciated them. Best wishes, Tucker Crowe. The title on the second was, P.S., and the message said, I don't know if you hang out with anyone on that website, but they seem like pretty weird people, and I'd be really grateful if you didn't pass on this address. Was it possible? Even asking the question felt stupid, and the sudden breathlessness was simply pathetic. Of course it wasn't possible. It was obviously a joke. Even though it was a joke removed of all discernible humour. Why bother? Don't ask. She draped her jacket over the back of her chair and put her bag on the floor. What would be an amusing response? Fuck off, Duncan? Or should she just ignore it? But supposing... She tried mocking herself again, but the self-mockery only worked, she realized, if she thought with Duncan's head. If she really believed that Tucker Crowe was the most famous man in the world and that there was more chance of being contacted out of the blue by Russell Crowe. Tucker Crowe, however, was an obscure musician from the 1980s who probably didn't have much to do at nights except look at websites dedicated to his memory and shake his head in disbelief. And she could certainly understand why he wouldn't want to contact Duncan and the rest of them. The torch they were holding burned way too bright. Why Alfred Mantellini? She googled the name. Alfred Mantellini was a character in Nicholas Nickleby, apparently. An idler and philanderer who ends up bankrupting his wife. Well, that could fit, couldn't it? Especially if Tucker Crowe had a sense of self-irony. Quickly, before she could think twice, she clicked on reply and typed, It isn't you really, is it? This man had been both a presence and an absence in her life for 15 years, and the idea that she had just sent him a message that might somehow appear somewhere in his house if he had one seemed preposterous. She waited at work for an hour or two in the hope that he'd reply. And then she went home.
Tucker Crowe, from Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia. Tucker Jerome Crowe, born 1953, September 6th, is an American singer-songwriter and guitarist. Crowe came to prominence in the mid to late 70s, first as the lead singer in the band The Politics of Joy, and then as a solo artist. Influenced both by other North American songwriters such as Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, and Leonard Cohen, and by the guitarist Tom Verlaine, he achieved increasing critical success after a difficult start, culminating in what is regarded as his masterwork, Juliet, in 1986, an album about his breakup with Julie Beatty that frequently features in best of all time lists. During the tour to support that album, however, Crowe abruptly withdrew from public life, apparently after some kind of life-changing incident in the men's toilet of a Minneapolis club, and has neither made music nor spoken in the media about his disappearance since. Biography. Early life. Crowe was born and raised in Bozeman, Montana. His father, Jerome, owned a dry cleaning business, and his mother, Cynthia, was a music teacher. Several of the songs on his earlier albums are about his relationship with his parents. For example, Perk and Tickets from Tucker Crowe, Perk being the abbreviation for perchloroethylene, the chemical used in the dry cleaning process, and Her Piano from Infidelity and Other Domestic Investigations, a tribute to his mother written after her death from breast cancer in 1983. Crowe's older brother, Ed, died in 1972, aged 21, in a car accident. The inquest found that he had significant levels of alcohol in his bloodstream. Early career. Crowe formed the Politics of Joy at Montana State and dropped out of school to tour with the band. They split up before they were offered a recording contract, although most of the members of the band played with Crowe on his albums and tours, and his third album was titled Tucker Crowe and the Politics of Joy. Crowe's self-titled first album, released in 1977, was a famous music industry disaster. The record company's confidence in the artist led them to place a series of advertisements in trade magazines and on billboards bearing the hubristic tagline, Bruce plus Bob plus Leonard equals Tucker, underneath a photograph of a pouting Crowe wearing eyeliner and a Stetson. A drunken Crowe was arrested for attempting to tear a gigantic poster down on Sunset Boulevard, Hollywood, California, in October 1977. The rock critics were merciless. Greil Marcus in Cream ended his review with the line, "Drivel plus Fainus plus John Denver equals not much to go on." Stung, Crowe recorded a savage four-track EP, Can Anybody Hear Me?, now the name of a website given over to earnest, sometimes pompous discussion of his music, which helped to turn his fortunes and the critical reception around. Concert tours. Crowe toured extensively between 1977 and his retirement, although his live shows are generally regarded as being variable in quality, mostly because of Crowe's alcoholism. Some shows could be as short as 45 minutes, with long breaks between songs, broken only by Crowe's abuse of and evident scorn for his audience. Other nights, as the justly celebrated At Ole Miss bootleg demonstrates, he played for 2.5 hours to ecstatic, devoted crowds. Too often, though, a Crowe concert would degenerate into name-calling and violence. In Cologne, Germany, he leaped into the crowd to punch a fan who had repeatedly requested a song he didn't want to play. Most members of the Politics of Joy had quit before the end of Crowe's career, most of them citing abuse from the singer as the reason for departure. Personal life. Tucker Crowe is presumed to be the father of Julie Beatty's daughter, Ophelia, born 1987, although her mother has always denied this. He's believed to have achieved sobriety. Retirement. Crowe is believed to be living on a farm in Pennsylvania, although little is known about how he has spent the last 2 decades. Rumors of a comeback are frequent, but so far unfounded. Some fans detect his involvement in recent albums by the conniptions and the genuine articles. The album Yes Again, 2005, by the reformed The Politics of Joy, is regarded, wrongly according to the band, to feature 2 songs by Crowe. Juliet Naked, an album of demo versions of the songs on Juliet, was released in 2008. Discography. Tucker Crowe, 1977. Infidelity and Other Domestic Investigations, 1979. Tucker Crowe and the Politics of Joy, 1981. You and Me Both, 1983. Juliet, 1986. Juliet Naked, 2008. Awards and nominations. Crowe received an honorary degree from the University of Montana in 1985. Juliet was nominated for a Grammy in the Best Album category in 1986. Crowe was nominated for a Grammy in the Best Male Rock Performance category for You and Your Perfect Life in the same year.
Chapter 4. While Annie was waiting hopefully in her office for Tucker Crowe's reply, Tucker Crowe was wandering around his local supermarket with his 6-year-old son Jackson, trying to buy comfort food for somebody neither of them knew very well. Hot dogs? Yeah! I know you like him. I was asking whether you think Lizzie might. I don't know. There was no reason why he would. I've forgotten who she is again, said Jackson. I'm sorry. She's your sister. Yeah, I know that, said the boy. But why is she? You know what a sister is, said Tucker. Not this kind. She's the same as every other kind. But of course she wasn't. Tucker was being disingenuous. As far as the 6-year-old boy was concerned, a sister was someone you saw at the breakfast table. Someone who argued with you about what TV shows to watch. Someone whose birthday party you tried to avoid because it was so pink. Someone whose friends laughed at you a fraction of a second before you left a room. The girl who was coming to stay with them was 20 and had never come to stay with them before. Jackson had never even seen a photograph of her, so he could hardly be expected to know whether or not she was a vegetarian. It wasn't as if this were the first time Jackson had had a mystery sibling thrust upon him, either. A couple of years ago, Tucker had introduced him to twin brothers he'd previously been unaware of, neither of whom had remained a consistent presence in his life. I'm sorry, Jackson, she must seem like a different kind of sister to you. She's your sister because you've got the same dad.
Who's her dad?
Who do you think? Who's your dad?
So you're her dad, too?
That's it.
Like your Cooper's dad?
Yep.
And Jesse's?
Cooper and Jesse, the recent twin fraternal inductees. You're getting it.
So who's her mom this time?
Jackson asked the question with such a pained world weariness that Tucker couldn't help but laugh. This time it's Natalie.
Natalie from my preschool?
Ha, no, not Natalie from your preschool. Tucker had a sudden and not unwelcome flash of the Natalie from Jackson's preschool. She was a 19-year-old assistant, blonde and sunny. There was a time, as James Brown once sang.
Who then?
You don't know her. She lives in England now. She lived in New York when I knew her.
What about my sister?
She's been living in England with her mom, but now she's going to college in the U.S. She's real smart. All of his children were smart, and their intelligence was a source of pride, possibly misplaced, seeing as he'd only really been around for Jackson's education. Maybe he could at least take credit for choosing to impregnate only smart women. Probably not. God knew he'd slept with some dumb ones.
Will she read to me? Cooper and Jesse read to me, and Gracie.
Grace was another daughter, his eldest. Tucker couldn't even hear her name without wincing. He had been an inadequate father to Lizzie and Jesse and Cooper, but his inadequacies seemed forgivable somehow. He could forgive them anyway, even if the children and mothers concerned were less indulgent. Grace, though, Grace was another story. Jackson had met her once, and Tucker had spent the entire visit in a cold sweat, even though his eldest daughter had been as sweet-natured as her mother. That just made it all worse somehow. Why don't you read to her? She'll be impressed. He put the hot dogs in the shopping cart and then took them out again. What percentage of smart girls were vegetarian? It couldn't be as high as 50, right? So the chances were that she ate meat. He put them back into the cart. The trouble was that even young female carnivores wouldn't eat red meat. Well, hot dogs were pinky orange. Did pinky orange count as red? He was pretty sure the strange hue was chemical rather than sanguine. Vegetarians could eat chemicals, right?
He picked them up again. He wished he'd sired a hard-drinking 30-year-old mechanic from somewhere in Texas. Then he could just buy steaks and beer and a carton of Marlboros and be done with it. That particular scenario, however, would probably have involved him impregnating some sexy 30-year-old Texan waitress. And Tucker had misspent his youth on deathly pale English models with cheekbones instead of breasts. And he was now paying the price. And now that he thought about it, he had paid the price then, too. What had he been thinking of? What are you doing, Dad? I don't know whether she eats meat or not. Why wouldn't she eat meat? Because some people believe that eating meat is wrong, and other people believe it's bad for you, and some people believe both.
What do we believe?
I guess we believe both, but we don't care enough to do anything about it.
Why do some people believe it's bad for you?
They think it's bad for your heart. There was no point in talking to Jackson about the colon.
So your heart could just stop beating if you ate meat? But you eat meat, Dad.
There was a tremulous note of panic in Jackson's voice, and Tucker cursed under his breath. He'd walked right into this one like a sucker. Jackson had recently discovered that his father was going to die at some point in the first half of the 21st century, and his premature grief could be unleashed at any time by anything, including the main tenets of vegetarianism. What made it worse was that Jackson's existential despair had both coincided with and bolstered Tucker's own. His 55th birthday seemed to have sparked a particularly acute bout of melancholy that he couldn't see being lifted too much by any of the birthdays to come.
I don't eat so much meat.
That's a lie, Dad. You eat tons. You had bacon this morning, and you cooked burgers last night.
I said it's what some people believe, Jack. I didn't say it was true.
So why do we believe it if it's not true?
We believe that the Phillies are going to win the World Series every year, but that's not true either.
I never believe that. You just tell me to believe that.
He put the hot dogs back on the shelf one last time and ushered Jackson over to the chicken. Chicken was neither pink nor orange, and he was able to tell Jackson of its health-giving properties without feeling like too much of a liar. They went home, dumped the shopping, and then drove straight over to Newark to pick up Lizzie. Tucker was hoping he'd like her, but the signs weren't promising. They'd emailed back and forth for a while, and she seemed angry and difficult. He had to concede, though, that this needn't necessarily mean she was an angry and difficult person. His daughters had found it hard to forgive the parental style he'd adopted for his early kids, which had ended up revolving around his complete absence from their lives. And he was beginning to learn that some of his children always reintroduced themselves to him at some big watershed moment, either in their own lives or in the lives of their mothers. And that tended to weigh the visits down somewhat. He was trying to cut down on introspection, so he really didn't need to import it. On the way to the airport, Jackson chatted about school, baseball, and death until he fell asleep. And Tucker listened to an old R&B mixtape that he'd found in the trunk. He only had a handful of cassettes left now, and when they were gone, he'd have to find the money for a new truck. He couldn't contemplate a driving life without music. He sung along to the Shy Lights softly so as not to wake Jackson, and found himself thinking about the question that woman had asked him in her email. "It isn't you really, is it?" Well, it was him, he was almost positive, but for some reason he'd started fretting about how he could prove it to her. As far as he could see, there was no good way of doing it. There was no detail in his music too trivial to have remained unnoticed by those people. So telling her who had contributed uncredited backing vocals to a couple of the songs wouldn't help. On just about every single scrap of the biographical trivia about him that floated around the internet, like so much space junk, was all untrue as far as he could tell. Not a single one of those creeps was aware that he had 5 kids by 4 different women, for example, but they all knew that he'd had a secret child with Julie Beatty, pretty much the only woman he'd avoided knocking up. And when would they stop going on and on about something that happened in a restroom in Minneapolis? He tried very hard not to overinflate his importance in the cosmos. Most people had forgotten him. Very occasionally, he supposed they'd come across his name in a music review. Some of the older journalists still used him as a point of reference sometimes. Or there'd be an album in somebody's old vinyl collection, and they'd think, oh, yeah, my college roommate used to listen to him. But the internet had changed everything. Nobody was forgotten anymore. He could Google his name and come up with thousands of hits, and as a consequence, he'd started to think about his career as something that was still current, somehow, rather than something that had died a long time ago. If you looked at the right websites, he was Tucker Crowe, mysterious reclusive genius, rather than Tucker Crowe, former musician, ex-person. He was flattered at first by the people who devoted themselves to online discussions of his music. It helped restore some of the things that had been worn away by everything that had happened to him since he quit. But after a while, these people just made him feel ill, especially when they'd turned their cranky attention to Juliet. Still, if he'd kept making albums, he'd probably be a tired old joke by now, or at best a cult hero carving out a subsistence living in clubs, or occasionally as the grateful support act for a band that he'd apparently helped kickstart, although he could never hear his influence in their music. So, stopping had been a very smart career move, provided, that is, you ignored the lack of a career that was the inevitable consequence. Tucker and Jackson were late, and they found Lizzie wandering up and down the line of limo drivers waving signs, in the vain hope that Tucker might have sent a car for her. He tapped her on the shoulder, and she turned around, scared. Hey.
Oh, hi, Tucker?
He nodded, and tried to convey without words that anything she wanted to do was fine by him. She could throw her arms around his neck and cry. She could peck him on the cheek, shake his hand, ignore him altogether, and walk to the truck in silence. He was becoming an expert in what he was beginning to think of as paternal reintroduction. He could run classes, probably. There were enough people nowadays who could use them. If Tucker didn't disapprove of national stereotyping, then he'd describe Lizzie's greeting as English. She smiled politely, kissed him on the cheek, and still somehow managed to suggest that he was representing all the pond life who'd been unable to get to the airport due to other commitments. And I am Jackson, said the boy with an impressive moral gravity. I am your brother. I'm very pleased to meet you. For some reason, Jackson took the view that verb contractions were inappropriate at occasions of this magnitude. Half-brother, said Lizzie unnecessarily. Correct, said Jackson, and Lizzie laughed. Tucker was glad he brought him along. The conversation during the first part of the drive home was easy enough. They talked about her flight, the movies she'd seen, and the couple who'd been reprimanded by a steward for inappropriate behavior. Canoodling, Lizzie called it after detailed questioning from Jackson. He asked after her mother, and she talked about her studies. In other words, they did as well as they could, seeing as they were two complete strangers sharing a motor vehicle. Sometimes Tucker was mystified by society's obsession with the natural father. All his kids had been raised by competent mothers and loving stepfathers, so why did they need him? They, or their mothers, always talked about wanting to know where they came from and who they were. But the more he heard that, the less he understood it. His impression was that they always knew who they were. He couldn't ever tell them that, otherwise they'd just think he was some kind of brutal asshole. The tenor of the conversation changed on the last stretch before home when they'd come off the freeway.
My boyfriend's a musician, said Lizzie suddenly.
Good for him, Tucker said.
When I told him you were my dad, he couldn't believe it.
How old is he? 45?
No.
I was just kidding. Most young people don't know my work.
Oh, I see. No, he knew it. I think he wants to meet you. Maybe next time I come, I can bring him.
Sure. Next time? Surely this visit was some kind of probationary period, if not a job interview.
Maybe at Christmas.
Yes, said Jackson. Jesse and Cooper are coming at Christmas, so it would be fun if you came too.
Who are Jesse and Cooper?
Oh, shit.